Hey, Mark, why don't you tell us about our brand new sponsor?
All right, Jeff. Funky Soul Coffee is a 70s-themed mobile coffee bar in a specially renovated 1975 Airstream trailer. The owners, Michelle and Gavin, have been renovating the Airstream themselves and are planning to launch later this summer. Their dream is to create a unique coffee shop experience that inspires you to reach for your dreams, too.
Idaho History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right, you are listening to Idaho History, the podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wade, sitting with your other host, Mr. Mark Iverson. What's going on tonight, Mark?
You know, just ready for some action, Jeff.
Heck yeah. Oh, this one's going to be action-filled, isn't it?
Well, yeah. You know, last week, on the last, the Magruder podcast, I said to you, you know, or at least to our public, our listeners.
That whatever you want to call them.
Whatever, yeah. Our fans, our adorers, our admirers. But I said that essentially we're going to be talking about the Aryan Nations and the fight to get rid of them up in northern Idaho. But you know what? I lied. I figured in my desire to, you know, produce the best product that I can, that we can, but I am writing the script. I just want to take my time with this one. It's kind of a serious topic. And last week when we did the post about the introduction of this idea to see how people responded, most people responded really well, but there were definitely a lot of people that said, well, don't uncover that. Don't dig that up again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, you know, what's the purpose of talking about that again? And it was like, well, you know what? Generations die. I wish it wasn't so because I'm getting older. Ooh. And you have to reteach these things or yet, you know, they get re-entrenched again, you know.
Well, I see a lot of it coming back already at our current time period. So, yes, we do need to talk about it. We do need to discuss it. So,
yeah, I mean, it's like if you just put your head in the sand, well, that's what Europe did in the 1930s and the 20s.
Yeah.
And, well, look at what happened, you know, do nothing, you know. Retreat, and you know, zealots are going to come after you.
It's true
because they think their way is right, and if they think their way is right, they're going to fight for it. And so, you better fight back. And so, this is our way to fight back. And so, here's the thing: education is important when it comes to hate speech and fighting it. And so, I think I want to do a really good job. So, I got, you know, a lot of great sources through the North Idaho College archives and special collections that have to do with human rights and the fight against the Aryan Nations. Some books about Bill Wasmith, the father, the priest that led the campaign, among other people for sure. And I just want to take my notes properly, although I don't really take notes. I just mark pages and passages, and then I go back through them.
Yeah.
But anyway, so tonight we're going to take on another topic that I've researched quite a bit, and you know quite a bit about, and I just think it's really interesting, and is just kind of the crazy shit that happened on the Boise River.
Okay.
You know, from roughly 1811 to 1862, before Boise City was even around.
All right. So you got some sources for this one, Marky?
Oh, I sure do. I have, you know, multiple diaries of people that took the Overland Trail, the Oregon Trail. One of the families that I used a lot was the Eakin Family Diaries. There was the Ward Massacre we'll talk about that happened on the Oregon Trail just outside of Middleton. So I have the, you know, firsthand accounts of Newton Ward, one of the survivors, as well as William Ward. Those are the only two survivors of a group of like 20 people. Mm-hmm. I have some of the orders of Major, what's his name? Haller.
Haller.
It's in my notes, and he talks about going after the culprits that attacked them.
Yes.
For the fur trading, we have Alexander Ross's journal, Nathaniel Wyeth's journals played a little part, Donald McKenzie correspondence with the Northwest Fur Company, which was active in the valley, a great book, Astoria by Peter Stark. The Historians by the famed Washington Irving, who did Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
That's right, yeah.
Boise, The Peace Valley by Annie Laurie Bird. And History and Culture of the Boise, Shoshone, and Bannock by William Edmo. And then last but not least, and there's some other ones, lots of articles from various papers, but The Indians of Idaho by Deward. And this is more like an anthropology, and it's very old and dated, but sometimes it's the best you got.
Well-sourced, sir. Well-sourced. So let's talk about the Boise River Valley and the history of it real quick, and we'll set up the foundations that way, and then we'll get into more of the craziness, right?
Sure. I concur, sir.
All right, let's do this. So approximately 12,000 years of civilization... Okay, not starting well. approximately 12,000 years of civilization has existed within the confines of the Boise Valley, an area running from what is now the Lucky Peak Dam area in East Boise to the junction of the Boise and the Snake Rivers near Parma, Idaho, and then northwest of Eagle. That's where the bands of hunters and gatherers sought shelter and hunts at the upper reaches of Dry Creek some 3,000 to 4,500 years ago. Now, they sheltered under a rock overhang where in 1991, archaeologists excavated two burial chambers and 17 hearths. Artifacts found include beads, arrowheads, a flint knife, and some carved figurines.
Yeah, this is the Dry Creek Rock Shelter. I tried to find this freaking thing, and I went way off base, I think. I think it's on private land, and it was snowy, and I just reached a fence.
You tend to go out in the snow and the mud and get stuck, so yeah.
I know, but this time I didn't have a vehicle.
Okay.
Just my legs.
Nice.
And I went off trail like any good outbacker. Or wait, that's in a different continent.
Yeah,
backpacker.
Backpacker.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, okay. So, you know, the same hills and the river valley sustained the Boise Shoshone, the Northern Paiute, and the Bannock for many generations before the arrival of Euro-Americans, or as I like to say, white people.
Yes.
So when explorers, traders, and trappers migrated west, many of them came right through the Boise Valley, following the river. When many thousands of Americans headed west starting in 1841, they came through this valley.
On a map that old William Clark had drawn after talking to other Shoshone peoples and on his return back to the east, the name, okay, this is a native name, so bear with me. Is it Kop-po-pa-ash? Kop-po-pa-ash?
Yeah, Kop-po-pa-ash.
Okay.
Yes. And I'm still pretty sure we're screwing that one up. But
yes. Yeah, apologies to our native speakers. Mm-hmm. And that's the Shoshone Bannock name for the Boise River Valley. And that translates roughly to Much Cottonwood Feast Valley. And that was written on William Clark of Lewis and Clark, his map that he had, that he acquired, right?
Well, no, I mean, so he talked to all these dudes being the Shoshone and other tribes in the north, because, you know, they came up through Lewiston. Mm-hmm. And on, you know, he would take notes and he would kind of start drafts of these maps. And then when he goes back, you know, after the core discovery is concluded, well, basically he draws all these maps. And later fur trappers and ventures use these maps.
So then in 1811, the first white travelers entered the Boise Valley, and these were the Historians.
Yeah, explorers, trappers, and traders of both British and American interests trapped along the entire length of the Boise River. But the first occurred when, in 1811, business giant of New York...
John Jacob Jingleheimer Smith.
John Jacob Astor sent forth two parties of explorers, trappers, and traders to erect a trading post at the mouth of the Columbia River on what is now the Oregon coast.
So Astor named his new venture the Pacific Fur Company. One group went by sea and the other overland. Now, Mark, did they have to go by sea all the way down around the Cape, I'm assuming, back then?
Yeah. That kind of sounds sucky because they puked and had a lot of hard time.
Got sick. Yeah. Very treacherous journey, almost as treacherous as going overland. So it's like kind of a toss up how you wanted to die, I guess, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
So they named the post that they founded on the Oregon coast for Astor, which is the present day site of Astoria. And then when the overland band of Astorians arrived in the Snake River Basin, they were hungry and near starving. In a bid for survival, they split into four groups near a point on the river named Cauldron Lynn. One of these groups, led by Wilson Price Hunt, came upon the Boise Valley from the east. Somewhere near what is today the Barber area. That's where they do the Shakespeare Festival, right?
It's sure bad.
I've been there, but I want to.
It's pretty good.
Is it?
Shakespearean? Yeah, actually, but the funny thing is, Michaela and I have gone, and we've never seen Shakespeare. It's like Agatha Christie. Yeah, so, you know, in famed author Washington Irving's account of the Astorian Venture, he describes the scene when the small group arrived in the valley. The next day brought them to the banks of a beautiful little stream running to the west and fringed with groves of cottonwood and willow. On its border was an Indian camp, where Boise now stands, with a great many horses grazing around it.
Irving continues, "At this place they camped for the night and made sumptuous repast upon fish and a couple of dogs procured from their Indian neighbors. The next day they kept along the river, but came to a halt after 10 miles march on account of rain. Here they again got a supply of fish from the natives." Mark, was that schnauzers that they were munching on? Or
I don't know, but I can only imagine they'd probably be gamey and lean.
It's true, yeah.
Creatures, but you know what? If you're starving like those dudes were,
yeah,
that stuff will look like, I don't know, Panda Express.
It's true.
I mean, you might as well just dig in, you know what I mean? Mm. But so the 10 miles puts them right in the vicinity of Eagle today, along the river where the Shoshone established their various camps. These trappers noted the multitudes of beaver along the Boise, and in 1813, historian John Reed returned and set up the very first Fort Boise, near the confluence of the Snake and Boise Rivers, roughly where Vail, Oregon is today. This fort was really just a small post intended to establish trade with regional tribes.
Yeah, they unknowingly established their post near the territory of a small group of outcast Bannock, nicknamed the Dog Ribs, who did not favor immigrants or outsiders. After several threatening incidents, Reed moved the post and built a new one where present-day Parma is located, on a spit of land between the confluence of the Boise and the Snake. They trapped along the Boise, establishing camps farther upriver, including along tributary streams of the Boise, including a favorite spot noted in the expedition journals, 20 miles away from the post. This constitutes the area running from between Middleton and Starr today.
Reed and his party found beaver, but they also faced many dangers. One member of the party was killed by unknown assailants and scalped. Another died of scrofula. We talked about that in an episode before. Basically, tuberculotic lesions on and around the throat, the neck,
our Dr. Hart episode.
Yes. And this stuff is nasty. But anyways, outside of somebody's, you know, body, a horrible way to go. Most of the Shoshone were friendly in the area, and they stated surviving members of the Astorian Venture, but dangerous tribal bands called the region home as well. And in January of 1814, Reed and all his men, 7 all told, were murdered by the Dog Ribs. A group friendly Shoshone ran to warn Marie Dorion, one of the women married to a trapper, Pierre Dorion, and though she attempted to warn her husband, she was too late.
We talked about in our Snake War episode how there's, you know, the Shoshone, and then within the Shoshone tribe, there are smaller bands, and one band might be friendly, one band might not be friendly, and that's kind of what we're dealing with here, right?
Well, yeah, and when you get more whites coming out, you know, west, you get more of the blaming one group, you know, for something they didn't do, or maybe you established a peace within one band that was a larger band, but you know, the young men in this group didn't agree to the peace, and they were the warriors.
Right.
You know, I mean, there was all sorts of reasons. So you had lots of blame. And I mean, the same went for the other way around, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so.
So after the Reed party was killed, word went around the region that the men were massacred due to a slight by a member of Reed's party against a member of the Dog Ribs. This trapper, word said, had taken off his hat and slapped a Dog Rib with the hat several times about the face, causing great offense. I mean, that would piss me off.
Yeah.
However, the Dog Ribs hauled in 40 guns after killing the trappers. Marie Dorion found the location of the massacre soon after and shared, quote, "Sad was the sight of Mr. Reed and the men all murdered, scalped and cut to pieces." She then undertook a Herculean bid for survival with a baby and a young child tied to her over the winter of 1814, being saved by a friendly group of Walla Walla and taken to some Astorians trading in the area.
Ultimately, the Astorians failed in their venture and were incorporated into the Canadian Northwest Fur Company, which eventually incorporated under the name of the British-owned Hudson Bay Company. However, the trails used by the Astorians and other trappers traders, originally cut by the area's tribes, became the Oregon Trail, including the main trail that passed by this area on the south side of the Boise River. Trapping in the area eventually resumed, but no whites entered the Boise Valley again until 1818, when Donald McKenzie, once a captain with the Pacific Fur Company at Astoria, arrived at the confluence of the Snake and Boise Rivers.
Here he set up headquarters in the same place Reed had his post back in 1814, but now as a member of the Northwest Fur Company. McKenzie employed 10 what they called Sandwich Islanders at the time, or Hawaiians, and we talked about that back in our Idaho Mythbusters episode, right?
See.
And 30 Iroquois hunters from America's Northeast. And so McKenzie and his men began trapping along the Boise River, where they became sick due to eating bad beaver meat. The beaver seasonally subsisting on plants poisonous to humans. The cure was reportedly gunpowder mixed with grease, which future trappers would depend upon to heal themselves of the, quote, beaver sickness.
That damn beaver fever, Jeff. Once you get it in your bloodstream, you're damned.
Of course, yeah. And like I said, if you want to know more about that and the origin of the name Malad River, you can check out our Idaho Mythbusters episode. We talk all about that.
Interesting aside, the castor glands of the beaver were even removed to be made into powder aimed at stimulating the male libido.
Ooh.
Beaver glands were the Cialis of the 17th and 18th centuries. Millions, perhaps billions, of animals were slaughtered in the name of virility and fashion. That's what I thought you meant by beaver fever.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, whatever.
Wait, does that actually work, though?
I don't know. I haven't been able to slay a large rodent and
we'll have to try that
process sometime. Its castor gland yet.
We are getting old, so.
We need that.
I can't afford the blue pill, Jeff.
Anyway, moving on, please. Okay. Please.
Sorry, buddy.
So, don't really have time to relate the entire story here. McKenzie, like we're talking about, had a very interesting trip when he and his men made it to where Table Rock sits and also where downtown Boise is today. One account, that of fellow trader and friend Alexander Ross, describes McKenzie and his men surrounded by a group of Shoshone interested in stealing the party's goods. The surrounded traders set up a small breastworks and attempted to defend their property. The trappers threatened to blow a keg of gunpowder to ward off further attacks.
As the band of Shoshone were regrouping to try again, a party of Nez Perce approached the Boise on its southern bank. They intimidated the Shoshone with yells and whoops, scaring them into fleeing. Lucky for McKenzie and his men, the Boise was flowing too fast for the war party to cross, though they continually charged the river, attempting to ford the waterway.
You know, the Nez Perce did a lot of great things for white people, and we screwed them over.
Oh, that's a fact.
Yes.
That's just a fact, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not all equal. I mean, the screwing of each individual tribe was pretty bad, but yet there were ones that were, I think, a tad bit shittier than other ones.
Yeah, and we'll get into that. I want to do the Nez Perce War here soon, and yeah.
That might be a couple episodes.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's, I've always thought it was one of the most tragic Indian wars myself.
But. Well, and here's the thing about the warriors, and we hit upon this earlier. For the Shoshone, I know, and I'm sure to some degree for the Nez Perce, stealing goods from other warriors, which the fur trappers were and looked like, mm-hmm. As far as horses and other, you know, guns. Yeah, it was a sign of manhood and bravery, and mm-hmm. so this was an important thing for warriors to do, and so this is one of those things where it's like, oh, the whole tribe was, you know, quote-unquote savage or, you know, dangerous, and it wasn't necessarily true. But anyway.
So Mackenzie and his men were forced to retreat to a small wooded island across a channel in the Boise with their property and created defensive positions. They waited 22 days until the rest of their party appeared. Now numbering 75 men, the trappers left the island in force. They soon arrived at a large camp where the city of Boise now sits. The Shoshone were gathered to fish the river for salmon. The trapping party, it is claimed, decided to set their camp on what is now referred to as Government Island. The men then conferred with tribal leadership. A chief, cited by multiple sources, going by the name P-I-M.
P-I-M.
P-I-M?
Yeah.
Okay. That's not how you have it.
That's how they wrote it in the journal.
Okay.
P-I-M.
But Chief P-I-M requested that all hostilities toward the trappers cease at that time.
Trapper Alexander Ross also came to the Shoshone encampment in 1824, where Boise now stands, and he met a leader by the name of, P-I-M, again. P-I-M's brother was also a leader, and they were both big, big dudes, and they were very fierce kind of guys, but wise.
Big feet.
Big feet. Yeah. I don't think these are the same guys. These are a little predate that, I think, but P-I-M invited Ross to a peace conference with his enemies, the Cayuse. And so Ross went to sit down with 10 men, and in his retelling, he describes an interesting encounter. The chief's lodge was quickly put in order, with a fire in the center, when the ceremony of ratifying the peace commenced. The two Cayuse plenipotentiaries were placed in the back part of the tent by P-I-M, and I next to them. 18 snake dignitaries next entered and squatted themselves down on each side of us. Lastly, P-I-M sat opposite to us with his back to the door, apparently with the intention of keeping out all intruders and preventing anyone from either going out or coming in during the sitting. And just let me say here real quick, the snakes were a white term for the Northern Paiute, the Bannock and the Shoshone.
Yeah. You know, we talked about that lengthily on our snake war episode. So
yes.
You might listen to that one if you are confused on what a snake Indian is.
Yeah.
To use a...
not a proper term today.
Right. Yeah, thank you. And that quote was from Ross's journal, I'm assuming, correct?
Correct. Yes. Okay. Of his Snake River trips, expeditions.
So then Ross shares that a pipe was lit and P-I-M inhaled 3 times, but never exhaling the smoke. Instead, he swallowed it. The pipe was passed to a member of the Cayuse delegation next. He was warned not to exhale any smoke. The 3 Cayuses smoked, never exhaling, before the pipe was passed to the rest of the circle. Stifled by smoke, Ross attempted to leave, but was refused by P-I-M. In a shrewd move of diplomacy, P-I-M showed off his power to both the trappers and his old enemies, the Cayuse. He showed the Cayuse that he and his tribes were friends of the trappers and powerful enough to bring them to negotiation. He showed the trappers that he was the leader to deal with at the time. Then a peace was struck and relative security existed in the Boise Valley up to the 1850s.
Yeah, I didn't, talk about it in the script, but basically, if those Cayuse would have exhaled, peace wouldn't have existed and they possibly could have been killed. So it's like,
damn,
puff, puff, pass. Right. You better freaking keep it in those lungs, son.
It's like every time I try to smoke, they just start coughing. Yeah. Or like
right. Yeah. It's a sign of manhood and whatnot. Right. So.
Well, that's wild.
But so more trappers and traders would come through the valley along what would one day be the Oregon Trail, both British and American, and down the Boise River Valley over the 1820s and 1830s. When the valley and the larger Snake River Basin became a central battleground. Okay, I'm going to just start over.
This is what happens when we drink.
I don't even think it's that. It's just the... So more trappers and traders would come through the valley along what would one day be the Oregon Trail, both British and American, and down the Boise River Valley over the 1820s and 30s, when the valley and the larger Snake River Basin became a central battleground of economic warfare between the United States and Great Britain. The Hudson Bay Company was an economic arm of the British Empire, which, in the 1820s, viewed the Columbia River region as a location to further expand their fur trading empire. HPC leadership saw a potential buffer zone in the Upper Snake River Basin that they hoped would settle the territorial dispute between the two nations, both of which sought control over the fertile valleys of Oregon and much more.
Yeah, just to tie into that, this whole area would have been known as the Oregon Country at the time.
Oregon Country. Oregon.
And then later it was the Oregon Territory, of course.
How did the British say
it? I don't know. That's a good question.
Oregon.
Oregon. I don't know. So the HBC looked to overtrap the Upper Snake Basin and our beautiful valley. This would make the company money, and it seems misguided now that would also discourage American immigration to the Pacific Coast and territories beyond. This was the, quote, fur desert strategy of the HBC. It seems ironic that one of the company's forts, Old Fort Boise, built in 1834 near the location of Donald McKenzie's old 1818 trading post, ended up being a haven for tired, threatened, and starving American pioneers traveling the Oregon Trail.
So, though the British traders made a lot of money in the area where the, you know, American Pacific Fur Company eventually failed, the Americans won the long game and settled the fertile Western territories. There are so many more adventures we could include, like Captain Benjamin Bonneville, Peter Skeen Ogden of Ogden, Utah. Right? Ooh. Isn't that it?
Yes.
Nathaniel Wyeth or George Fremont.
Fremont County.
But he's different from the Fremont of California. Because there are two Fremonts, right?
I don't know about California, but...
Because there was a Fremont that went to California.
Sure.
By the 1830s or so.
I just remember that question on our trivia episode that... The two counties that were named after explorers. One was Fremont, and what was the other one?
You said Payette, which made sense.
Yeah.
But Bonneville. No, that's a dam. Shit.
Oh, there's Bonneville County, though. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, I should have gotten that point.
Yeah.
The whole thing's rigged.
So, you know, we could talk about George Fremont and all those other fucking guys, but...
These fucking guys.
Yeah, these fucking guys, right? We're talking about Joe Pesci, Ray Liotta, you know. Because what do you tell me, Robert De Niro's having himself another kid? That's kind of gross and also fucking great at the same time.
72 years old having a kid.
I think his baby comes out of the womb going, hey.
Hey.
Yeah, I digress.
He's going to be... Never mind.
He's going to be in Scorsese movies any day.
So he's going to be dead by the time that kid is out of diapers.
Jeez, dude, I know they don't have kids and whatever, you know.
So at least he can leave a nest egg behind.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, let's go on with the show.
Hey, De Niro, we love you. So anyway, but the important point is that though the Boise Valley was remote and pure average 1820s American, like going to the moon, the area in which we live today was economically important to the two competing nations, one an empire and the other a republic, a democracy, a republic, whatever.
That's interesting to think of how the Boise Valley fed the British Empire for a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, this was, I find that fascinating. So, like, it, you know, yeah, they didn't have open warfare, but there are times where, you know... different interests, you know, back different tribes that could be hostile to one group or the other, especially the Americans. But anyway, the Boise Valley and the basin around it in a whole would play a more prominent role in America's future.
In the late 1830s, the fur trading period slowly transitioned into a new economic age, one in which multitudes would place their hopes for brighter futures either on what they could find beneath the earth or what they might grow from it. Man, that line is poetry, Mark. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
The Oregon Trail was not one central trail running directly to Oregon. One portion of the trail stayed south of the Snake River, which is called the South Alternate Trail, while another crossed the Snake at the Three Island Crossing and continued on towards Boise through the Camas Trail and down into the valley from up near Bonneville Point. Where the trail followed the south bank of the Boise all the way to Parma and across the Snake, where it merged once again with the portion of trail it left behind at the Three Islands.
You know,
I think there's even more shut, like the Goodale's cutoff was a different...
That came after 1862, but it was based on Jeffrey's cutoff. So Goodale's was like more of an extension from what I understand.
Okay.
But that's the thing about the Oregon Trail. I think, you know, back in, you know, grade school, I was like, yeah, yeah, it's a trail.
Right.
You know, it's like, nah, man, it's a shit ton of trails based upon where you think you might have a better chance of not dying.
I just think back to the video game, you know, you always have to choose which way to go.
I just killed everything.
Good.
I'm a horrible, horrible person.
You know they have that on the Switch now, right? No, that's like an updated version.
Oh, what? Really?
Yeah, it's so fun.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, it is.
I'd like to actually play it and think it through.
I'd like to go live it one summer. That'd be fun.
I'd like to dress like a fur trapper and run down the rivers, no matter how populated they are. Like, what's this nutcase doing in this subdivision? Along the...
Just see you on the Boise Dispatch Facebook page.
Just give me some mink!
Psychopath.
Yeah. Running through the fields. That's what I'm aiming for in Dementia, pal.
This is what happens when we drink.
We are having libations. Yes. We find that it leads to a better product. But so later, around 1852, a crossing was established further back from back near Fort Hall along a new route named Jeffrey's Cutoff.
Oh, Jeffrey.
With its western portion becoming Goodall's Cutoff in 1862. Timothy Goodall. He was a badass that people don't know about, really. But
we didn't talk about him.
We should talk about him more. Yeah, we
just want to do like a whole bunch of Oregon Trail, because there's a whole lot to explore there.
Yeah.
Literally explore.
That's right, dude. Goodall's route came through Boise, down Main Street, and up Harrison, before Harrison came here, of course, and William Henry. And this is approximately so. But after that, going up Harrison, it ran along the edge of the foothills as it headed west towards Hill Road, before turning northeast just east of Eagle, approximately where Hill Road merges with Highway 55. The actual physical journey on the Oregon Trail was treacherous, uncomfortable, and long, just like my marriage. Kidding, dear. Honey, I love you. You don't listen to these anyway.
I'm going to message her and tell her.
Okay, you should.
Yes.
She knows.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. And the Boise River Valley offered approximately 55 to 60 miles of slight respite from the dry sagebrush and lava rock plains they had been enduring since entering Idaho, dotted with groves of cottonwood and willow trees to camp along the river. Some of the first immigrants to travel the Oregon Trail, including the Boise Valley's portion, were Marcus and Narcissa Whitman in 1836. The Whitmans were Methodist missionaries on a journey to settle and convert Western tribes to Christianity. They traveled with Henry and Eliza Spaulding, Presbyterian missionaries who would establish the Lapway Mission among the Nez Perce near what is Lewiston today. And Mark, I think both of those couples actually deserve an episode. I know we talked about not doing the Whitmans because it was established in Washington, but I think it has a lot to do with Idaho history, so we'll include that one.
I mean, they were taking their missionary positions.
Exactly.
You know, and that's an important thing to talk about.
She did get pregnant on the trail, so Narcissa did.
What an unpleasant name.
Narcissa.
Isn't that a Harry Potter character? Maybe I'm a... But it just sounds like an evil, scary person. But anyway, that's just me. If there are any Narcissas out there...
Please write us an email.
What do they call you? Narc?
Not
Narcissa.
Yeah, sure. I'd actually like to know if we do have any listeners named Narcissa. Because I like the name, actually. I wouldn't name my daughter that, but...
Yeah, it's kind of got like a dominatrix kind of thing, too. Yeah. But, yeah, I digress.
Please.
Yeah. By 1842, Oregon fever had taken hold of the minds of many Americans. Explorer John Fremont came west to map the Oregon Trail in 1843. Eventually writing a popular report relaying information for interested parties back east. Economic troubles, an outbreak of malaria in the Mississippi Valley, and just basically letters being sent back home increased promotion of the lands out west, and the promise of free land combined to drive immigration westward. I say emigration, not immigration, because it's within territories, right?
Sure.
But Americans set off on the trail from Independence, Missouri, heading west 2,020 miles to the Willamette Valley in Oregon country, and to many other locations. One thing was sure, all would experience varying degrees of hardship on the trail.
Did you say free land?
Free land! I think of Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, damn it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when I thought that was history.
Right.
Life was simple then.
Yes.
You know.
Remember watching that in high school?
I'm like, shit, all I have to do is box like a badass.
Right.
And I'll just get out of New York. And
yeah. It didn't work so well for Leo, though.
Oh, dude, he got all munched up in The Revenant.
Yeah.
Is that what the one you're talking about?
No.
What are you talking about, Quick and the Dead?
Never mind.
Okay.
That's not what I'm thinking of. Anyway.
Gangs of New York. Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah, maybe that was what.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The pioneers traveled in covered wagons, generally speaking, but did not ride in them as much as you might think, the wagons being packed with all sorts of worldly possessions. These wagons had no shocks, so they, well, they had leather springs, basically.
Well, up in the seat, the riding section, mm-hmm. but like in the back, a lot of them, most of them didn't have anything like shocks under the axles, really.
Yeah.
Maybe a buffer.
Even if they did have some kind of... Yeah, buffer or something. They bumped and rattled, and it would hurt to ride in these wagons the way through. Many rode horses, mules, and simply walked. Oxen, horses, or mules, which usually they had four or more, generally pulled wagons, and the men tended to ride out front to spot for game or other threats. Trains could be as large as 1,000 people, many with multiple livestock or much more. Immigrants brought seeds, bushes, and even whole trees for transport.
Yeah, I actually read that some of these larger wagon trains, they had like a whole governing structure with rules and articles to follow.
Yeah.
And then they had captains, and it could be like a dictatorship if you messed up too much. You know, you had to...
I'm going to do a quick book recommendation here, Mark.
Oh, sure.
There's a great book. It's called The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey by Rinkerbuck. Him and his brother actually traveled the trail, I think it was like in 2014 or so.
Oh, yeah. I know the book you're talking
about. Yeah. So they actually bought an old wagon or a reproduction wagon, and they traveled the trail just like they would have back in the day. And he talks about how... when he was riding in the seat, he would get so beat up every day that he just... eventually, when he wasn't driving the wagon, he would just walk alongside it.
Yeah. And that's what people did every day. I mean, they walked like 15 miles a day average. And some people, you know, they would take a break on Sundays, you know, for the Lord's Day.
The Sabbath.
The Sabbath.
Yes.
But a lot didn't. And so it was just constant, you know. I mean, 2,000 miles plus of walking.
But this book is great because he talks about all this. He talks about how hard it was on the trail. He doesn't, because he goes through Idaho, but he doesn't talk about Idaho too much. But spoiler alert, I guess, he gave his mules to a couple down in, what's this town down here? Not Murphy. Anyway, they're here in southern Idaho.
Oh, yeah.
Where they ended up staying, yeah.
The gift of ass.
Yes.
Yeah. So wagon trains traveled slow, not much more than 3 or 4 miles an hour, and the dust was horrible in hot, dry weather. Mud became like glue, with wagons getting stuck constantly in, you know, the spring months and the winter. But during the hot weather, wheels shrank and had to be soaked in water because, you know, they were made of wood with an iron ring in the middle. And so they had to be soaked in water overnight to expand, the wood to keep it expanded, so essential metal rims could be refitted to the outer ends of the wheels. Wagons would flip in rivers and people drowned. It was dirty along the trail. Feces was all over the place. Descriptions of these freaking camping sites are disgusting. Yeah. Dead things, Mikey, dead things. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, goodness.
Yeah. But
water holes were contaminated, and there weren't many opportunities to wash. Stock and people died and were left where they were, laying or in shallow graves, usually under or close to the road with no marker. Animals dug people up, and corpses were a constant reminder of the worst that could happen.
And if you don't like my book recommendation, a great way to watch a good representation of this is the show 1883.
Oh, do they have a lot of that in there?
Oh, yeah. Dead animals.
But that didn't happen in 1883. Oh, they go before 1883.
No, it took place in 1883.
But do they, like, pre-lead up to 1883?
They show the Civil War. Is that what you're talking
and
about?
And they come on the Oregon Trail in a particular time?
Yeah, 1883.
Damn, what? That was still the Oregon Trail?
I know the train was going, but you had to be rich, right?
I guess. Yeah. I didn't really think much about it.
Yeah. Okay. But there were other dangers, such as disease, which claimed the most lives, upward of 6 to 10% of travelers, and not just people that died, right? 6% overall of the people that traveled died of disease.
And this comes from the National Park Service, my friend.
They would know. With cholera, a.k.a. the Blue Death, typhoid fever, dysentery, diphtheria, and the measles being among the most common culprits of the disease deaths. The Oregon Trail has been, in fact, called the nation's longest graveyard due to many deaths along the way. Most diseases occurred as a consequence of poor sanitation or due to tight living arrangements where coughs or simply breathing would transmit highly infectious illnesses. Mark, some of these wagon trains had hundreds of wagons in them with, you know, 5 to 10 people for each wagon. Yeah. So you had hundreds of people traveling together. Yeah, not good. Winfield E.B., leader of a wagon train traveling through the Boise Valley in 1854, believed that cholera from which he suffered resulted from the, quote, Platte River with its wide bottoms and miasma, which is like foul air, that engenders so much sickness. So he had cholera and then...
Yeah, he was speaking specific to the Platte River, but, you know, he was talking about he believed that miasmas caused disease. You know, and this made it tough for people to believe that because every time somebody would fart in the wagon, everybody had to jump out. You know, right. I mean, it was, if that's what you believe caused cholera. People with cholera could expect to die quickly in most cases.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Symptoms started with a stomach ache that grew to intense pain within minutes. Then came the diarrhea and vomiting that quickly dehydrated the victim. Within hours, the skin was wrinkling and turning blue. If death did not occur within the first 12 to 24 hours, the victim usually recovered.
That's a rough way to go.
Three members of Winfield Ebbie's party succumbed to cholera. Sarah Sutton, a traveler also hazarding the trail in 1854, came through the Boise Valley, camping 27 miles distant from Fort Boise. Puts her somewhere around where Highway 16 or the Central Valley Expressway meets with Highway 44. But Sarah mentions four Indians... coming to trade fresh salmon for a shirt and some powder and caps. After crossing the Snake River again at Old Fort Boise, she wrote that since leaving Fort Hall, between there and Old Fort Boise, she had seen more graves and dead cattle than on the rest of the trail combined. So this was the most unsavory portion of the trail in the 1850s.
I believe it. Other dangers included snake bites, accidents with livestock, falls from wagons, being maimed by wheels, drownings, gunshot wounds, and rarely from Native Americans. Though this was more of a threat in the 1850s, most of the tribes along the trail sought to trade and actually helped weary travelers survive. Many immigrants brought along goods to trade in exchange for fish, berries, root vegetables, and often moccasins and other clothing to replace worn-out boots and garments. Prior to the ferry crossings, the tribes of the plains and those in Idaho aided wagons cross the rivers, such as the Snake, as they did near Parma at Old Fort Boise. In the Boise Valley, if you were to take a time machine back to the 1840s and 50s, during the right season, you would see Shoshone and Bannock encampments scattered up and down the Boise River.
And they lived in wickiups or conical shelters with a foundation dug about 2 feet underground and covered with tightly woven mats. Made of reeds, bark, and grasses. Animal skins were used to cover the wickiup. Later,
so this is different than a teepee. A teepee is meant to be packed up and moved. A wickiup is like more of a permanent structure that they would change the animal skins, you know, every so often or whatever.
And they would leave it for other bands that would come through the area, you know, and understanding that that was, you know, they could either make new, you know, habitations in their other hunting areas that they would travel to up in the mountains or the hills, or you know, they'd be left behind for them.
Right.
But later, after the introduction of the horse in the 1730s and 1740s, many Shoshone began to live in teepees, adopting the habits of the tribes of the Great Plains due to the horse's ability to carry the long and heavy wooden lodge poles needed to erect teepees. The Boise Shoshone, however, controlled the upper and central Boise Valley, you know, and they were the ones to use the wakeyups because it was easy. It was where they were, and they weren't as connected to the plains tribes that most tended to use the teepees. Mm. But anyway, the Shoshone that controlled the upper and central Boise Valley shared the lower Boise Valley and the area around Parma and Snake River with the northern Paiute and the Bannock people, originally who had been northern Paiute, the Bannocks.
Upon entering the Boise Valley, Winfield Eby wrote in his journal that, quote, reaching the plain, the course of the stream, the Boise, is marked by a line of green timber. I could see the camp fires from the Indian villages along the river. Another member of the party noted, a good many Snake Indians visited camp, offering, as usual, to trade their ponies for rifles. No trade was affected. The Eby train was traveling down the Boise on August 19, 1854, one day before one of the most brutal atrocities along the Oregon Trail occurred.
The Ward Party was on a, you know, only... The Ward Party was only a day behind the Eby train, or Eby train, I don't know. One or the other.
Yeah.
And though the Ebys had no issues with the tribes in the valley... The Wards would almost be decimated by a group of Shoshone Bannock from out of the area called the Winnostas, at a location just outside Middleton, Idaho today, like 2 miles away or so.
Yeah, we were going to go record up there, but we're not sure about the weather. You know, it's May in Idaho. It changes in a second.
Plus, we're going to do it at night, and if there is a haunted frickin' place, that would do it.
Yes.
You know, it's just mass grave right there. But the massacre occurred about 16 miles away from what one day would be downtown Eagle. It was horrible to read the primary accounts from survivors and those parties attempting a rescue from Old Fort Boise, but these given prior to the sensationalized, you know, recollections printed in the paper. So the closer it is to the actual event, the closer the people were to what happened, the more truthful I usually find the statesman. There's a slip. The misstatement.
Predates the statesman.
Yeah.
About 20 years, right?
Right. But in the papers. But we know that 18 immigrants were killed. We know 4 men died trying to defend the group by gunshots. They died going out. And if that's the way you wanted to die, I guess, because... the 2 that were hiding in the wagon were taken, dragged out, and murdered. Mm. And, you know, the remainder of the women and children were killed in very, you know, in horrendous ways.
Yes.
The women being violated and tortured, you know, and...
One boy was rescued after hiding in some brush with a severe blow to the head, and another was shot in the side with an arrow and crawled most of the way to Fort Boise. And again, this is old Fort Boise at Parma, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's where he was saved. You see, the trail became more dangerous as more pioneers took to it. More devastation to the environment on all sides of the trails deprived the tribes of southern Idaho of the game and the important camas roots, a favorite delicacy of the livestock, most especially pigs. The reality over the period from 1840 to 1860 was that, quote, sustained attacks by Indians on immigrant wagon trains were rare. Although conflict did occur, historian John Unra notes that thievery and not murderous attack constituted the major threat posed by Indians. In fact, the mutual aid between Indians and overlanders was much more common than violent hostility. And that's from the National Park Service.
One traveler named Johnny Grant, who spoke some Shoshone, talked with some of the snakes, as they called them, from the valley, who relayed to Grant that the massacre happened because 2 snakes riding behind a wagon train were shot at and 1 was killed. Some horses had been stolen and members of the wagon train simply shot 2 men trailing the wagon. Family of the slain attacked the next wagon train they encountered in retaliation and killed everyone. It can be agreed that between whites and Native Americans, one atrocious act led to another.
And this story encapsulates tensions between immigrants and the tribes perfectly. Native Americans were deemed savage by many immigrants, a subclass of humanity below the whites. They were thus often killed more readily by whites. In turn, violence toward innocent pioneers could be vicious and brutal, as they were seen in much the same way. In reality, an invading force taking lands lived on for thousands of years.
So, I don't know if I want to go to that. Fuck. What? So, there's some accounts of just prior to the Ward Massacre, there were some white people among the natives that visited the Ward camp.
Yes,
the day before. And that's an episode I want to do in itself, because there are several accounts of what we call white renegades among the natives at the time. I kind of want to go kind of in depth into some of those stories. So we're going to be talking about the Ward Massacre. Probably do a whole episode on Sunday.
I think Newton Ward actually talked about seeing a couple of white men dressed as Shoshone or snakes, as they called them, trying to trade for horses and try to take horses. And it was kind of an aggressive affair from what I remember.
In kind of from what I've read is that it was these white renegades that were really pushing the natives to act violently. So, I mean, you don't take all the blame off the natives for the attacks, or, you know, I don't know if you can really blame one side more than the other, but we'll talk about it.
It's impossible to know what all led up to the Wenas-Tas doing what they did. But whatever did lead up to what they did, I remember a guy on Facebook got so pissed at me once when I was talking about this, but I'm like, what the Wenas-Tas did, especially torturing the women and children, you know, and the rape of the women, that's horrible.
Yeah.
That's a crime. That's an atrocity. But this happened to Native Americans elsewhere too. And so, it's wrong no matter who does it.
Right.
And you know, I'm just trying to, and I think I know you understand, but people wanted to be like, oh, well, white people are all bad. People wanted to be, the tribes were savage and horrible. But that's not, history is never so simple.
Yeah.
And you could be part of the systematic conquering of a great many peoples in the way of American westward expansion, and you could still be a victim.
Yeah.
While you're part of something that's huge, victimizing many, many different civilizations.
Exactly.
You know, and that's the fucking reality. I don't care what anybody says. Put that in your Kool-Aid, folks.
Yeah, like I always say, shades of gray, right? As with the Reed Massacre in 1814, the Ward Massacre was not perpetrated with the support of the entire tribe, but it was the actions of a small contingent of the Wenas-Tas, friends of the Bannock. In September of 1854, the United States Army sent Major Granville Haller.
Haller.
And approximately 100 men, as well as a small contingent of Nez Perce and Cayuse, up the Boise and the Payette Rivers to capture the Wenas-Tas. They made their way 35 miles up the river to an encampment of 7 lodges believed to house the perpetrators. This is roughly 2 miles from downtown Eagle, somewhere in the vicinity of where the entrance to Eagle Island State Park lies, from the location of Old Fort Boise in the Old Fort Boise WMA outside of Parma.
Wildlife Management Area. You know, they have in Parma, they have the Old Fort Boise. It's cool. You know, there's a little kind of like, it's cement, but...
Great statues.
Great statues of Marie Dorion. Oh, my goodness.
2 foot.
But if Maya, my daughter, and I did this several years ago, we went down to the Wildlife Management Area, and there's a memorial right where the old fort actually was. Mm-hmm. Most of the fort and its remnants are somewhere under the Snake River and all that sediment down there.
Right.
But it's this old, almost paper mache-ish looking horse.
Oh, yeah. I've seen pictures of that.
Yeah. And it's just off in the weeds. And you're like, what? Interesting. And it was put out there in the 1920s. They found the article about it and everything. But it's pretty interesting. But the remainder of those guilty from the Wenas-Tas, the army believed, were encamped 30 or more miles up the Payette. They found garments taken from the Ward train at the camp of the Wenas-Tas, you know, the Payette camp, but they didn't find the Wenas, themselves. They returned later to the Boise River and made camp at the same spot near the entrance of Eagle Island State Park, and named it Camp Mansfield after a Colonel Mansfield back there in the Dalles in Oregon area. But here the troops rested the animals for a week. From here they searched farther up the Boise going east. They killed 5 Winnestas on the mission, took women, children, and the elderly prisoner, and brought them to the Dalles, Oregon, eventually.
In July of 1855, 5 more were captured at a council meeting at Fort Boise. One was killed trying to escape. The other 4 were brought to the site of the massacre, where they watched gallows built and were hanged above the victim's combined grave. The gallows sat as a reminder of other Indians in the area, or 2 other Indians in the area, for decades before they fell and were cleared. I heard they used them as fence posts for a while. The wood
foam. Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Well, repurposing.
Yep. And now where the monument now stands is where the buried lie and the Winnestas were hanged. They did not act as a deterrent the army expected to, and the area became off-limits to immigrants until 1862 and the discovery of gold in the Boise Basin.
Yeah, in fact, one of the lieutenants under Haller actually wanted to leave the bodies hanging there, too. But then he thought better of it.
And he cut him down, right?
Yeah, and he cut him down, but he left the ropes hanging.
That's right, yeah.
You know, with just the loop-de-loo cut off there. And, you know, and they reacted pissed just at the gallows, obviously. But can you imagine if they would have left the bodies hanging there? That's like what they did in, like, the medieval ages, you know, head on a pike kind of thing.
I imagine the natives could have went and burned the gallows down anytime they wanted because the military pulled out.
So yeah.
Who knows if this is a...
Yeah, it could be. I don't know, but
yeah.
The thing is if this... I know they left the gallows there because it's in the reports by the troops, right?
Okay. Yeah.
But the thing is that this shows you the lack of understanding of the military, of the peoples there, you know, living and conquering and all that, that they were helped by Shoshone and Bannock, and yet they left this there and pissed off the whole shebang.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then, of course, you know, after you find gold and more whites are coming through, the hostility is growing anyway because it's about survival at this point. It's kill or be killed.
Yeah.
Die or, you know, whatever, but... But 1862 marked the year travelers returned to the Boise Valley. It was also when Goodall's Cutoff, named after mountain man and trail guide, which we talked about, Timothy Goodall, became a popular alternative route on the main trail. As we previously established, the trail crossed the Boise River where the Oregon Trail Memorial Bridge spans the river. From Main Street up what is now Harrison along today's Hill Road, then over the hills above Eagle to Emmitsville after 1864, but from Emmett, travelers could take the road to the Boise Basin or to Baker City, where they joined up with the main Oregon Trail once more. Sections of the trail could still be seen and walked. After 1862, travelers from the east, as well as those returning from the west, thronged to the gold fields of Idaho, especially the Boise Basin and the Boise Valley.
George Grimes struck gold in August of 1862 up northeast of Eagle in the basin surrounding Idaho City, below what is now called Grimes Pass. His discovery prompted a mining boom in the area and led to the establishment of towns such as Pioneer, Quartzsburg, Placerville, Centerville, and Idaho City in 1862 and 1863. Others came to establish homesteads in order to farm and provide food, especially fruits and vegetables, to the miners. One of them was William McConnell, who built the farm in near Horseshoe Bend.
One of the access ways, yeah. Up Harris Ranch. Or no,
I think it's called Paris. Harris Ranch.
Harrison.
Harrison Road.
Yeah.
Anyway, he would truck in his fruits and vegetables up all the way into the Boise Basin and sell them for a premium price.
Oh, yeah. Money. Like, expensive on today's market kind of stuff.
He tells a story of, like, a watermelon he sold for $10, and the miner, like, happily purchased it to show off for a woman.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Like, here is a piece of fruit. Grab my melon, honey.
But that led to the first homesteaders, which began to settle. So. But that led to the first homesteaders, which began to settle the valley in 1862 and 63 at places like Middleton, Eagle Island, and where Boise now sits. Many relied on programs offered by the federal government to acquire their lands. We keep kind of joking that we're going to do a whole episode on these, but I don't know.
The most boring and dry. The Land Allotment of 1820, the Homestead Act, the Desert Land Act, the Timber Act, the Carry Act.
We don't need to talk about this.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, the Homestead Act and the Land Act.
Basically, the government giving a way for people to purchase land.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But on Eagle Island, for example, a guy named Truman Coe Catlin, who ventured west in 1862 to Walla Walla in the Washington Territory, and like many others, he returned east to work a gold claim in the Boise Basin. But he called it quits as a miner, and he claimed 160 acres on Eagle Island in 1863 by asserting squatters' rights afforded him via the 1841 preemptive claim offered by the government. He would later use the Land Act of 1820 to purchase 133.5 acres of his land in 1871. The first home he built on the island was a rustic log cabin, 10 by 12 feet in dimension.
Early settler cabins were drafty due to the many cracks between the logs, attested early Eagle Island resident Lida Johnson.
Lida.
She was born in 1864 on the island. The cracks were constantly being filled and refilled with mud to close up the cracks. Lida shared that if the fire went out at night during the fall, and especially the winter, the cabin became freezing cold, which dangerously so. Someone always needed to be ready to soak the fire or relight it in the morning. At first, Catlin grew vegetables for the miners in the Boise Basin. He soon began cattle ranching as well, finding true success raising and managing between 1,000 and 3,000 head of cattle at his operation's peak. In 1864, French Creole settler Polite Massé.
Polite Massé.
Trying to jazz it up.
Yeah.
Anyway, he settled on the island, becoming neighbor to Catlin. They soon joined efforts to construct the first irrigation ditch in the area. Maeser Massé traveled by boat from New Orleans to San Francisco in 1863 before heading east to the Boise Basin to mine. When he gave up mining for homesteading in 1864, Eagle Island consisted mostly of cottonwood trees, sand, and gravel bars. But the irrigation ditch Catlin and Maeser Massé dug, that helped convert 700 acres of this poor soil into fertile farmland.
Homesteading, I'm sure some of you who have worked on a farm or a ranch know, is hard work. It was harder back then. Sagebrush, trees, stumps, and rocks needed to be cleared. Soil required tilling and enrichment before planting occurred, and it was hard work the people of the Boise Valley knew very well. Other early settlers spoke of similar hardships and dangers in the frontier days. Universally, all homesteaders spoke of rising with the dawn, if not before, because animals needed to be fed, fieldwork was a constant issue, and household chores took all day. From heating water for the cooking and cleaning to doing your own laundry and making soap. Oh, and every once in a while, if everyone stunk so bad that the family had to bathe, you heated up the water, then shared the water one after the other. That is freaking gross. These people worked hard, and, there was sweat and dirt with animals and all that kind of stuff caked on you. Yuck.
You end up getting sick, right?
Yeah, right. Nasty.
Outhouses or privies were the norm. Imagine that in the wintertime.
I know, right?
Thank you. And security with no law around was a constant risk. Imagine doing your business at night in a privy with outlaws roaming the area, stealing horses. And then, of course, you have local tribes that harassed for decades. By the 1860s, they raided farms and took livestock to survive. The Aikens, the founding family of Eagle, faced these hardships when they lived on Eagle Island. Later in her life, Mary Aiken spoke of the hardships of those first years on the island. She describes their first home as being constructed of clapboards and batten, the place in which she birthed two daughters.
In 1888, the winter became so cold that frost formed around the cracks in the home, failing to melt despite a large fire. The river would flood and wash sections of the island away and often stranded them until the waters receded. When the Boise River did flood, getting across was terribly dangerous, if not impossible. In July of 1875, the Statesman reported the foolish attempt of one Mr. George Beasley in trying to get across the river when flowing fully to the north bank, so he could go directly to his farm near Middleton without having to, I forget what his real problem was, but, you know, whatever. But
well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because Middleton, the original town site, had to be moved because of flooding.
Had to be. There's so many interesting things about early settlements, you know, like the fact that, you know, lots of these, but Middleton and Star area, they would, you know, with the Bannock War that happened and the Nez Perce going on, they'd construct fortifications along the river, so they're close to water and things like that, which they could all go in. The whole town could go in and, you know, defend itself against possible attack. And they had one in Middleton.
What would they call those? Blockhouses, right?
Blockhouses, yeah. They had some. They had one in the Payette Valley and there are numerous places and whatnot. But anyway, back to the guy up on the river, Mr. Beasley. Orlando Rube Robbins, one of the most famous lawmen in Idaho, and I like to joke that nobody knows him, told him he shouldn't cross. You know, Mr. Beasley, you say you can't swim? Well, then you definitely shouldn't cross.
Well, instead of heeding the advice of Mr. Robbins, he got into the water, walked out about 5 feet or so, his wagon flipped, his horses drowned, and he miraculously washed up on Eagle Island, short of stock, product, and money, but still alive.
And there's so many stories like that, you know. Eagle Island was of particular interest to me, but, you know, there's a guy that tried to cross with all his pigs in a boat, and they had a rope across, you know, and it flipped, and all these poor piggies, you know, the guy barely got by. But
there's a story of Rube Robbins actually pulling a guy out of the river there, right?
Oh, yeah, there is. Yeah, he's, I think this Beasley guy might be it. I didn't finish the story, but yeah, he saves this poor guy.
Rube Robbins is an interesting character that we need to do a whole episode on. Because he was a badass.
I'm so interested in the early period. You know, that's why this period between 1811 and 1862, right before Boise was founded, and then just a little after, in the whole valley, interests me so much because it's a world that is really hard to kind of uncover, but it's rewarding when you do. And you know, you have these, you know, a lot of old newspapers and journals, and you know, correspondence between people settling the area. This is where it comes from.
Yeah, I grew up going to the water park there at Eagle Island, doing the water slide and the little beachy kind of area. And so that's what I think of when I think of Eagle Island. But they farmed all the way up until like the 1970s, 80s. The inmates from the old pen farmed it.
And it was originally called Illinois Island, I think, after Truman Catlin or no, Polly Mace, one of those two guys. But it was called Illinois Island until they saw that all these eagles were around, and so they called it Eagle Island. But there's so much interesting, you know, the area by Eagle was known for its violence.
Right, yeah.
There was a place where Dry Creek entered, you know, the Boise River, which, you know, you have to approximate because with the damming of the river, it changed so much. But you can still kind of vaguely tell distances. But there was a place called the Junction House, which, of course, or Nine Mile House, because it was 9 miles down the river as far as from Boise.
That's where you, like, 5 mile road, 10 mile road. That's because it's literally that distance from Boise.
And but the great thing, well, the horrible thing, but interesting thing, was that you see the violence in rural communities between people that didn't like each other, especially over things like grain disputes. You know, that's the person's livelihood, and you literally could go starving if you didn't produce the money you needed. And so, you know, you had a guy named Hamilton Maxson who owned this house, this Junction House, and, you know, he was involved in shootings. Later on, another Maxson was involved in the shooting of Jimmy Turner in downtown Boise at the Free Roll. And then you had, like, I forget the guy, Pony Lawrence.
His brother was killed a week before, and then he was shot over grain. And I heard the guy's name. And then up at the area where Floating Feather meets Eagle Road, there was a farm of a guy named William Richards who, over a couple of sack fills of grain, was shot by a guy named Thomas Weatherett. In 1869-70.
Yeah.
And on that same property, a year later, a guy named Drake, who, it was funny, the statesman said, the people of the area said, well, Drake was a fine fellow, but then he fell down in a wagon, rolled over his head twice, and after that, he just wasn't normal anymore. So he shot this guy that was his friend over $2.50. But he wasn't right, so they sent him to the territorial prison, the old Idaho State Prison.
Yeah.
And basically, it's funny because they're like, well, we can't keep him among the populations because he's plumb nuts, but he's gentle and he's not provoked, so they put him in the with the chef.
You know, you were talking about how different this area that we're talking about looks nowadays. And it's hard to imagine what it looked like back then. And a lot of that is because of the dams and how they control flooding of the river these days.
Right.
I mean, if you go out right now, again, it's spring in Idaho. We have a story in our Murder Mayhem book about two kids that drowned in the Boise River.
Yeah.
That was later on in the 1920s or 30s.
Yeah, but it still was different.
This is before the dams were able to control that
Smiley, water. Lucky Peak wasn't there yet.
Yeah.
Diversion Dam was there, and then Arrow Rock after 1915.
Yeah, so like I said, this is just really the dams. Not only, we create electricity, but you also are able to control that flooding. And there's an urban legend in Garden City that the city fathers wanted to get rid of the trailer park, which is down by the river, so they allowed it to flood.
Well, there's tons of stories that you find in oral histories, especially where they're talking about flooding and just like, the shanty towns. But there's so much interesting history along the rivers. And I'm not just talking about the Boise. That's an interesting way to investigate a state. Just, what happened along the Clearwater, as far as logging, and that happened on the Boise River, too.
Yeah.
As early as the 1864 or 5, they had log booms that they would take from up, in the Boise Basin.
Chinese mines along the Snake River.
Right,
One springtown right underneath the Hanson Bridge.
Cool.
Find that.
We're wanting to get down in those parts.
Yes.
Eventually. So help us do that. Make us rich.
Yeah, send us money.
But anyway, I wanted to cover the time period leading up to the settlement of the area, right?
Yeah.
And evidently, and it makes total sense, the first people that did the best, if they weren't, killed by something or died of some disease, they settled along the river and dug their own irrigation canals, which they would then claim right off the bat. Thomas Davis and Frank Davis, basically all that Julia Davis Park, that was all Tom Davis's land, and he controlled the water rights going all the way down the river, no matter whose, land it went through.
So he was able to sell those rights.
Yeah, he was able to sell that. Yeah. And that's confusing. But, and they could sell to, for instance, to keep the dust down in the summer, these big giant water wagons that would street sprinkle.
Oh, yeah.
And then the wealthier you were, the more they could sprinkle, and the better.
That's where the term on the wagon or off the wagon comes from, is those sprinkler wagons. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Okay. So, I can't remember the whole story, but that's...
I know shitface comes from people throwing out, that's never...
Yeah.
That's Edinburgh. But if you're up too early in the morning because you're all drunky, there was the time period when they'd yell "Gardy Lou," and they would throw, because Edinburgh had one of the first towns with high-rise kind of settled apartments and stuff. There was a time where you could throw your muck out the window, and then it would be cleaned up or run downhill into the drains. But if you were walking in those narrow alleys in Edinburgh, you get shit-faced.
So if you're drunk and weren't paying attention. Yeah, gotcha.
But anyway, that's a little off the Boise River, but hopefully a little bit more about the fur trade. That's only a small glimpse because, you had people come down to Boise and go up the Payette, and so, or down to the Oahe. So a lot of these guys would come
They would explore the Boise, but also the Owyhee River and the whole area. Like, you know, those Hawaiians or Sandwich Islanders we were mentioning, four of them died in the Owyhees, right? Some of those guys. And some of the Iroquois were like, well, screw me, these white guys. I'm going to go live with some people that look like me. And so, like, or some of them were killed. Like, it depends.
What strikes me, Mark, with this episode, we talked about how the Boise Valley, there were snakes, Shoshone, but there were also Nez Perce coming here, but there were also Cayuse coming here, Iroquois. Like, so crazy that this was kind of a meeting place, and I'm sure there was a lot of trade that was going on in this area, which is why they were coming here, right?
Yeah, in Weezer, I think it's a marked area, but there was an area on the Weezer River, or where they all came together somewhere around there, called... I'm going to mess this up. It's going to sound horrible, but Seehawaki and the people I'm getting that from mess it up, or Annie Laurie Burr, Peace Valley, was one of the ones. Great book, really. But it's written from a person in the 1930s point of view, but there's a lot of great description. But basically, all these tribes, sometimes as like far as like the Comanche and the Northwestern tribes all the way into Washington, and Oregon tribes, they would come in and they would, thousands of them would meet at these rendezvous for the Native Americans that did come. I think later mountain men might have come, depending on, but in this area, you could be at war with a tribe, like the Cayuse and the Nez Perce were at war in one, but inside this area, you could not fight.
Right.
And if you did, you couldn't come back.
One of the episodes I want to cover is the Battle of Pierre's Hole in the eastern Idaho, where they actually, it did turn into a battle and fight. So
at one of the rendezvous?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's this whole world that is just, the farther back you go, the especially in the West, the harder it is to uncover, but that's the rich reward, is when you find something, it's like an adrenaline rush when you find some firsthand account of something that not many people have seen.
Definitely.
But anyway,
let me bring that to you, good listener.
Yes, you ain't gonna get out there, read all these books, go to the archives, unless you're a total nerd like me and Jeff.
Yes. Anyway, I think we need to wrap this one up, Mark. It's getting a little long in the episode.
Well, after you edit it, it'll be cut down considerably, I'm sure.
Hopefully. Anyway, we're gonna come back next week, hopefully, talk about Aryans and Nazis in Northern Idaho.
We're gonna talk about. Simultaneously, a really great group of people, the Human Rights Task Force, headed by Bill Wasmith and a politician named Tony Stewart, I believe, and not the NASCAR driver.
Oh.
Not that guy.
Definitely not something you can just Google and find out, right?
No, sir.
And then I'm working on another one. My next one's going to be, we're going to start digging into some of the folklore of the state.
Yeah.
And one of the first kind of folkloric kind of tales I want to talk about is Chief Bigfoot. So I'm working on that. So I'm looking forward to presenting that to you.
What about the vicious little people of the Owyhees?
Oh, I guess I could mention that one in there, too.
Yeah. But you know what? Bigfoot's a good one. Let's just Bigfoot, stop there, yeah, I guess, Mark. Come on, buddy.
You're asking too much. Anyway, I think with that, we'll sign off and say see you later.
Sayonara.
Bye.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's County.
I wish there was more unique words for that, I guess, without, you know.
Kubar.
Kubar. It's all for. I'm going to start the whole thing over. That was dumb. All right. Damn kids.
Bastards. You get your rice rocket out of you, little fucker.
They used to race on Midway up here, back and forth all the time when we first moved here.
It drives you crazy.
Yeah, it's fucking dope. All right. Good idea.
I forgot about the negative impact of ice.
Yeah, it's loud.
I feel like this whole thing is kind of going poorly.
I like this. This is interesting to me. I don't know shit about this. So.
I mean, as far as...
Us talking.
Yeah, and reading and just all the...
That's all right. That's all right.
You think you can make it clean?
I can make it clean. Okay.
Zen. Zen. Find your zen.
I need a little zen garden.
Oh, chicory. Bonsai tree.
All right, quit drinking.
Okay, all right.
All right.